More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've missed any episodes of Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, you've missed more great stories from some of Rush's closest friends, family, and colleagues. All previous episodes are available now on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your podcast. Today on Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, a special treat. We are going to examine closely the Limbaugh letter.
Whether you listened every day,
you are at the EIB Network and the Rush Limbaugh program heard on over 600 great radio stations.
Or every now and then.
Nation's leading radio talk show, the most eagerly anticipated program in America.
These are the stories you've never heard from the people behind the scenes who knew him best and loved him most.
Rush Limbaugh having more fun than a human being should be allowed to have.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. Hosted by James Golden.
Hey, James Golden here. You might remember I told you a few weeks ago that MyPillow had sent me their entire collection. Well, you know what? It's amazing. They are so luxurious, and it's time that you experience some of that luxury too. MyPillow makes more than pillows. I love the pillow. I sleep on it every night. But you know what else they have? They have sheets that are simply incredible. They're smooth. They're soft. They're comfortable. I look forward to getting to bed every night under these sheets. Get yourself a set of these. They're called Giza Sheets. They come with a 60-day comfort guarantee. You get pillows. You get sheets. Oh, did I mention the slippers? They're incredible slippers. There is a level of comfort for MyPillow products that you simply have to experience. Log on to MyPillow.com. Click on the new radio listener specials. Use the promo code ICON, that's ICON. You'll find lots of incredible offers there right now. That's MyPillow.com, promo code ICON. Oh, we have with us the editrix of the Limbaugh Letter, Diana Aloko. Welcome, Diana. How are you?
I am wonderful. It's so good to hear your voice, James.
Well, thank you so much. Now, where do we begin? Let's begin at the beginning, Diana.
Hey, I have an idea. How about I ask you a question? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Do you remember the day that I cut off 500 radio stations from the studio?
No.
Yes.
No.
So I wanted to tell that story before you started asking me questions because it is so hilarious in retrospect. At the time, it was very traumatic for everyone. But if you remember,
what happened?
When I first started, they wanted me to sit in the studio to absorb all that I could of the atmosphere. And I sat to the right of you for a few years, if you remember. You were screening calls.
That's right.
And then I sat to the seat next to you. Then there was Mike Mamone and Kit in the room, typically. And this one day, Rush was remotely broadcasting. I think he was in California, but as long as he was there, it didn't really matter where he was. I don't remember where it was. But he was broadcasting remotely, and at the time, you would speak to him by pushing a button on the board every time you wanted to add or he had a question for you. So you would keep up your repartee that you usually did. Well, I used to have comments that he invited me to also make comments, and I would tell you because you were right near the microphone, and I would tell you my comment, and then you would tell Rush my comment. And after a while, I think you got tired of it, and you said, hey, why don't you push the button yourself if you have something to say to Rush? So fortunately, James, this was during an advertisement, an advertising break. I had something to say to Rush, and I pushed the button, and I went to make my comment, and all of a sudden, Kit and Mike and you started standing up and scrambling around, and it was like the ER, pushing buttons and redoing this and doing that. And I was like, what happened? And you said to me that I had cut Rush off from his entire EIB network of the main feed. So fortunately, you all scrambled and you all, you know, got the connection going again during the advertising break. And so Rush basically asked you, hey, what the hell happened? And you did not throw me under the bus. I'm still grateful for it. You said, oh, yeah, there was a satellite uplink glitch of some kind. You covered me. And as far as I know, Rush never knew what really happened, that you had some woman in the studio who basically pushed the wrong button. So,
okay. Let's talk about you for a minute. When did you first hear Rush Limbaugh? When did you first become aware that there was this guy on the radio, Rush Limbaugh?
Well, it is a really cool story, actually. I was the one of the four issue editors at the Reader's Digest, and it was my job to choose all the material for one full issue. There were four of us, and we rotated. And so I was working on, I believe it was the 1991, possibly May issue. And I was in charge of picking all the stories. And there had been, I believe, an Atlantic profile of Rush Limbaugh. And that was the first time I had ever heard his name. It was a wonderful profile, very positive. And I thought, man, this will be just perfect for the issue. It'll round it out. It's different. This guy has such personality. And it's radio, which we didn't have a lot of material on. So I scheduled it for that issue that I was putting together. And one of the editors who was working underneath me, whose job it was to edit it, condense it. Of course, we condensed everything at the Reader's Digest. She brought it in, finished, ready for my pen. And she said, by the way, you should listen to this guy. Because I said, man, he sounds so cool. She said, nothing competes with hearing him yourself. And that woman's name was Susan France. And I later hired her for the Limbaugh Letter, believe it or not. But she was the one who introduced me to the idea that you had to hear him. And I went out on my lunch break, turned on the radio in my car, and I was immediately hooked. I know everyone has those same experiences. And from that time, I spent every lunch hour in the editorial library at the Reader's Digest secretly listening to Rush's show as much as I could. So it actually was, you know, necessary for me to work for him because it was kind of unethical to be paid by the Reader's Digest and spending an hour listening to the Rush Limbaugh program.
So how did it come about that you became the Limbaugh Letter, the editrix of the Limbaugh, as Rush calls you, the editrix of the Limbaugh Letter?
Well, right after that, I think a month or two after that, I heard through the grapevine that Rush was starting a publication. And I thought, man, I'm made for that. And I saw an advertisement in the New York Times. That's how we found, there was no online applying for jobs or searching for jobs in those days. This was the early 90s. And so I read the New York Times. I was in publishing, and that's where the want ads were for the publishing world. And so I saw this little two-line ad, wanted editor for new publication combines humor and conservative politics. And I knew, I'm like, okay, there's only one person on the planet who combines humor and conservative politics. And since I already had gotten wind that there was a new publication starting, and so I sent to the company, I sent a two-line letter that said, I hear you're starting Excellence in Publications, and I am very interested, and I gave my contact information. So they called me, and I had an interview. You know what's fun? The second interview was with Rush himself, and I did not know it at the time, but it was because of something I didn't say in the interview process that I got the job. I didn't ask anybody about benefits. I didn't ask anybody about vacation time. I didn't ask anybody about anything other than what they wanted in the job itself. And I learned later that that was just a bugaboo that Rush had, that he couldn't stand people who just wanted to know as soon as they were being interviewed, what are the benefits and when's my vacation? And so the fact that I didn't ask those, what put me in the plus column.
Yeah, I remember the day you were first introduced to the staff. Beautiful, dark-haired woman comes in, and I'm like, wow, who's that? That's the person that's going to start the Rush Limbaugh newsletter. And yeah, and so you hung out with us in the studio a while, and then out rolls issue number one. And issue number one, I still have, of the Limbaugh letter. And it was what? It was like 4 pages, I think, when it first, was it 4 pages or was it?
It was eight.
It was 8 pages.
Eight pages. They started with basically two color newsprint, 8 pages. And, you know, to me, they had given me a few months to sit in the studio and absorb Rush as much as possible. And my job was to try and contain lightning in a bottle, basically, is to distill that down somehow into 8 pages every month, a daily radio show about the news. So that was a, you know, my greatest professional challenge, I think, was to figure out a way of containing him into print. And, you know, as much as it is possible. And that's why I immediately said, well, 8 pages is never going to be enough. And we bumped it up to 12 and then to 16, which is what lasted its whole life. And then we went full color because it had to be to contain Rush. So it was a real interesting thing to figure out a way. And I noticed that he talked big picture as well as news. And so I was trying to every month hit on for the cover story, help him, you know, basically convey his main theme of that month. So there were big picture items that would fit in a monthly publication. And that was the fun of it, is to write down, oh, yes, he's talking about this important subject, education or whatever it was. And then, you know, the smaller items we could do, the news items, the funny things and the stupid quotes. So we tried to combine both humor and substance. And he always wanted to do original research in the newsletter. So it wasn't a duplication of what was on the radio at all.
All right. Tell us what it was like working with Rush. First time you met him, it was the interview. What about after that? What happened? What was your relationship like with Rush?
Well, Rush was wonderful. I mean, I'm going to get choked up, but I loved him. And he was the best boss ever, because he, as I think you said earlier, he would choose self-starters and people that he felt would be independent, work independently, and just let us go. And so he was not a person who looked over the shoulder or micromanaged. He trusted us. And that trust was such an honor. And it really got the best work out of all of us. I think we all wanted to please him, and we all wanted him to be approving of what the work was. And so we gave it our very best every single day. And also we knew that's what he was doing. So he set the tone for excellence, you know, basically the entire team wide, and everyone worked well together because of that. We all had the same mindset. But I, you know, if you don't mind, I have a memory of a pretty funny thing where I think I got my nickname, Editrix. And this was in 1994. He wanted to do a reprint not only of the 35 undeniable truths of life, but also update them. So we had a new 35 undeniables. But as I was talking to him, he was standing in my office. I had the office next to him at the time. And he came in and we were discussing it. And I corrected him on the number 24, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women access to the mainstream of society. And I said to him, hey, Rush, you just worded that wrong. You've got too many words in there. It should be feminism was established to allow. You don't need the so as to. It's just superfluous. And so he looked at me after kind of giving me that one-eyed look. And he said, let me tell you. He says, you have 325 radio stations and then you can write it however you want. And I looked at him and I said, point taken. And I immediately, he laughed. He was being very funny, but he had a point. And I laughed and he laughed. And after that, he started calling me editress. So I think there was a little bit of dominatrix in because I had argued with him and I wanted to correct his reading.
Too funny.
So I got a note. I got an email here from the editrix at the Limbaugh Letter. That's the most widely read political newsletter in America. Dear boss, I sadly think your caller is right. I think Hillary is going to be on a higher platform to make her look equal to Trump. A podium, and she's got dictionary definitions here, as though I don't know what these things are. A podium. A podium is the raised platform on which the speaker stands to deliver his or her speech. Podium derived from the Greek word, as in podiatrist. A lectern is a raised, slanted stand on which a speaker can place his or her notes or secret teleprompter. Lectern is derived from the Latin word lectus, the past participle of the verb legere, which means to eat vegetables. The word lector comes from the same source. So... I was confused. Anyway, it's a long way of saying that the caller might have been right, that they're going to have her jacked up.
Each week on Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, we delve into Rush's biographical journey with the help of his friends, colleagues, and family members. Today, we welcome one of America's most loved actors and patriots, Scott Baio.
The Life of Rush Limbaugh, Chapter 10, narrated by Scott Baio.
On November 4th, 2008, America made history by electing its first black president. And known for his signature cutting-edge analysis and insight, Rush Limbaugh was quick to explain how Barack Obama was able to convince so many Americans to vote for him. In fact, Rush was very detailed as to why Obama's election victory was so decisive.
The main reason Obama was elected was a bunch of people in this country very distressed and fed up with the ongoing allegation that they and the rest of the country were a bunch of racists and bigots. And they believed that if they participated in electing the first African-American president, that they could do away with that charge. They could do away with that notion, that idea. Now, I firmly believe that the vast majority, outside of the Democrat, where the vast majority of white votes for Obama were made with that hope.
After 8 years of conservative leadership under President George W. Bush, Rush was eager, willing, and ready to resume his role as chief conservative critic in opposition to the Obama regime, as he frequently labeled it.
And it fits! What the hell else is it but not a regime?
It didn't take long for Rush to start making waves with only four little words just before Inauguration Day. I hope he fails.
I wanted Obama to fail so that my country would not. I wanted Obama's liberal agenda, his socialist community organizer agenda to fail. I did not and never have and never will want America to fail. Never. No way. I wanted America to be saved.
Rush soon found plenty more to criticize in what became the signatures of the Obama administration. From Obamacare to the closing of Gitmo, the Iran nuclear deal to Obama's border tactics and much, much more. For Rush Limbaugh, the Obama years were chock full of policies and bad politics to dissect for tens of millions of listeners daily. And throughout Obama's two terms in office, Rush took great pride in telling his listeners that he had no doubt the president was one of them. As he often explained on air, not only was Obama paying attention to him, he was fixated on him.
The Republicans are only concerned about what's on Fox News or what Rush Limbaugh's saying, and Democrats are looking at the New York Times or Huffington Post.
So Obama comes into office telling Republicans that they can't listen to Rush Limbaugh anymore and get things done. That's just not how it happens in Washington. And he's leaving office, having failed to remove one of his main impediments from his equation, and that would be me. So after 8 years, Obama, he comes into office with me living rent-free in his head, and I'm still there.
It can be said today that during the Obama administration, Rush Limbaugh was at his best, staunchly defending conservative principles and standing up for America and its exceptionalism. But in the end, whether at his best or even on a bad day, few could touch Rush Limbaugh. The Obama chapter was but just 8 years of more than 30 of unprecedented broadcast excellence.
Unforgettable. That's the impression that you, the Rush Limbaugh audience, made with your support for Rush's last charitable effort while Rush was still with us. Through the Stand Up for Betsy Ross campaign, your generosity resulted in a $5 million donation to the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Rush said it best.
We chose Tunnel to Towers to be the beneficiary of the campaign because we love the work they do. And the story about how they started. When a family experiences significant loss, the mother or father passes while serving our country, Tunnel to Towers steps in, frees that family of a major worry during their time of crisis. Tunnel to Towers pays off mortgages in full for these families and provides them with the comfort of a home when their world has literally been turned upside down.
The foundation does the same for first responders and also builds smart homes for our most catastrophically injured veterans and first responders. More heroes need your help. Do good by donating $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's the letter T, the number 2, the letter T.org. So this was a relationship that started in the 90s and continued right up until the time that Rush left us. And so all those years, I mean, what's your takeaway from working with Rush all of those years?
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember the Nightline appearance. I think it was April of 94.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yes.
He had been on along with Carville and some other, you know, one New York Times writer. And it was a town hall. It was supposed to be about Hillary and healthcare. And this was before the midterm elections where the Republicans took over, as they used to call it, the Republican takeover. So this was still in the honeymoon phase of the Clinton administration. And Ted Koppel really liked Rush at that point and had him on. He was the only one who wasn't physically in the town hall, I think Iowa. And he was supposed to talk about healthcare and Hillary care. And he was the first person up, and he immediately changed the subject, did not talk about anything other than all the lies that these people, the Clintons, had been promulgating about Whitewater. And he started talking, listing them. He rat-a-tat, you know, the billing records, Whitewater, and went on and on. And the rest of the group was there to talk about healthcare, and they simply just ignored basically what Rush had said. They didn't respond to it. And the next day, we were all, you remember this? We were all standing in the hallway before the show. And I said to Rush, "Hey, Rush, did you notice that you basically accused them on television, national television, of being liars, and they didn't defend her?" And he did what you and I used to call that sponge thing. He yep. would look so intently at you when you were talking, and he wouldn't necessarily say anything. And this was the first time I had experienced it. And he had this piercing look, and he listened to what I had to say, and he didn't respond. He just walked down the hallway to the studio, and then he kind of used that as his jumping off point. And then a few days later, there was the Pretty in Pink conference, because Hillary knew she had not been defended by her own people on national TV. And so that was the first time I knew he was probably the best listener that I have ever encountered in my life. He had the ability, and even after he lost his hearing, he had the ability to absorb information, filter it into this amazing creative mind he had, and be able to then transform it and bring it out as the Rush take, because he would take things that we all would suggest or give a line or whatever, and he would make it into something miraculous and amazing. And to watch him do that live, that ability to spontaneously think on 90 different levels at once, I tell you, that was, we all have talked about how much we love him and his generosity and his character, and all those things are true. And the thing that I also appreciate so much is his mind. The most brilliant human being that I have ever been in the presence of, and yet very, very gentle and kind and of all good character. But his brilliance was a sight to behold. We will never, ever, ever be in the presence of someone as brilliant as him again.
You made a reference to it, and I want to just get you to expand on it, the sponge. Rush had this uncanny ability to absorb information like nobody else. He could read something and pick out points that and find points in it and talk about points that no one else saw in an article. It could be a sentence, and he could then launch into an original take from that that would turn into a monologue. He would talk to people and something, a sentence that they would say, he could develop an entire line of thought that no one else in the media would have. This guy, he took everything in, and he would say show prep is, life is show prep. He would take everything in. He read an incredible amount of material every single day. He had to in order to do a show. But he would also listen. And you pointed that out too. He would listen to people on the staff. He would talk with them. And you didn't get a lot of time. It was just the most uncanny thing.
Absolutely. And I think you hit on something so important, and I'm sure other people have mentioned it, but not the conventional wisdom. The fact that he could not stand groupthink, he hated the conventional wisdom. It was almost physical with him. And so that natural inclination to ignore what everyone else's take was on something, that he wanted to make sure that whatever his observations were and his conclusions from that were absolutely original. And that is why everybody tuned in every day. And you and I, if you remember, we used to try and predict an event would happen, and we'd say, what do you think Rush's take is going to say?
Right, right.
And, you know, we would sometimes be close, but we were with him all the time, and we couldn't predict on a regular basis because it was so original. And that is something that I think so many people, especially as critics, took for granted about him, because they didn't understand that was why so many people tuned in every day. And you and I both know that he used to say something like, you know, saying more in 5 seconds than, you know, most hosts say in a lifetime. And that was so true. Once he moved to Florida and I started working from home, I could not leave my radio. I could not use the facilities in the house because I would miss 2 seconds of what he would say coming back from a break, and it would be important and significant. And so that hanging on to every word was due to his original thinking and because he was hilarious.
When you look back on it all, I asked the question one way, I'm going to ask it again. First of all, doing what you did is not easy, because Rush never wanted to, quote unquote, cannibalize the radio show. So he didn't want the same things in the newsletter exactly as he laid it out on the radio. And he would say that he did not want to cannibalize the radio show, but you had the job of making sure that this profound thinker who could articulate things so well also was represented in the print medium. And the print medium is very different than the spoken word medium.
Yes. And that was a hard challenge.
I'll talk to you about the issue that came out right after Rush passed. It was almost as if, I don't know, it was a God thing, I guess, because it was, you know, I'm with God, you know, or God is with me, actually. How did that issue happen? Did you kind of, was there some sort of sense of knowing? What how did that issue come about?
Well, it was really interesting how that came about, because I think Rush knew, because that was a throwaway line in a long monologue about something else. And I thought that the sentence that he said on the air was so poignant. And he said, God is with me. And I put that on the list of suggestions. It wasn't the first, because he was talking about other things, but I did put that on because I thought, what a powerful sentence that just was. And he chose that for the cover. And at the time, of course, I didn't know. We knew he was very ill, but we didn't know. And I think he may have. And that's why he picked it. And he chose the art of him basically with praying hands. And that was a beautiful cover. And I felt so honored to have helped that come about, because I know Catherine held that up at the CPAC meeting. And so that meant a lot to her, and it meant a lot, I think, to all of us.
How are you going to remember Rush?
You know, I mostly as great, just his greatness. And, you know, you know when you're in the presence of greatness. And he was so, he didn't wear that on his sleeve. He was so wonderful to be around, fun, just, you know, hilarious. And he always interacted with people as equals. You know, it was, there was never a sense, I'm the great one, kiss my ring. There was none of that. He would just joke around with everybody, and he enjoyed that. And however, just being in his presence and knowing how wise and wonderful and brilliant and how he helped this country. I remember when I first was hired, that at that time, there was the similar feeling in the country. You couldn't say out loud the things you thought. And here was this guy on the radio. Do you remember people used to call up and say, are you allowed to say this on the air? People were shocked to hear their own ideas and wisdom reflected back at them in such a compelling way. So what he did was, he gave voice to all of us, and I have been so honored to have that be part of my career as well, is just to be a supporter of getting his message to as many people possible, that America is wonderful and we will fight for her. So I would say his greatness, and I think the term you used was, you know, a second generation founding father, and you wrote the cover story for that, for the Limbaugh Letter last month, and that he is going to be remembered as one of the greatest Americans who ever lived.
Yeah, I miss him. So before we wrap up, I'm going to ask one more time, anything else that you'd like to add that you haven't said?
Just what an honor it's been personally for me to be part of this team. And, you know, I will remember with just great love and joy every single moment that I was a part of the Rush team.
Now, I'm going to just say this to you, folks. Diana is one of my best friends on the face of the earth.
Oh.
There was a time when I first started working with Rush that, and Diana had come on board. And I realized how brilliant this woman was. And I felt almost inadequate And I remember asking her, how do I, it was so funny. It's like, how do I get as smart as you people, as you guys? Do you remember that? Do you remember those conversations? Oh, you don't remember
no,
that?
No, I don't remember that because it was, because it's obviously so not true. I mean, you are way quicker than me and you have got all kinds of wit and wisdom. No. And if anyone could predict a rush take, you were as close
so
as you
I,
could get.
So what I did was, though, you recommended that at the time, because I kept pressing you on it. So you recommended that I watch two or three different shows. I won't reveal what they were because they're all gone now anyway. You said every night, if you really want to get to where the landscape is politically in this country, watch this, 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 read this, 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 this. And within 2 or 3 months, you'll have it down. And I did. And I did.
What good advice.
Yes, what good advice. And but beyond that, you know, you have with the Limbaugh letter, like everybody else that reads the Limbaugh letter, it is an impressive body of work that you and Rush put together there. And I hope that that Limbaugh letter is looked at by historians and by educators for what it is. It is truly reflective of a time, those 33 years, those that 30 period. How many years did you didn't start at the beginning? How many years?
Nope. Started in the first issue was the October 1992 issue. So this October will be our 29th anniversary. Yeah.
So for 29 years, almost 30 years, the Limbaugh letter stood as the number one political newsletter in America, and you are largely responsible for that, along with Rush. And what an amazing thing, Dana.
Well, Rush is the one, the inspiration for it all. And I have to say, at the time, a lot of people copied him. And there was the various newsletters I won't name from other hosts who I won't name. And they lasted maybe a year or two. And Rush has lasted this long. And it's because of him.
Yeah.
But I gloat.
No, you recite history honestly. Well, all right, Diana, thank you. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, James.
The parable about a picture's worth 1,000 words. The Limbaugh letter this month was worth a whole library. It was great. The cover of the Limbaugh letter, it says it all.
Well, thank you, sir. We don't get a lot of calls about the Limbaugh letter, but when we do, everybody on that staff just loves it. The Limbaugh letter is 16. People don't know how difficult that is. Because look at 15 hours a week here on the radio that is then reproduced on the website. And yet here's this 16-page monthly publication that's now gone digital. What do you do to put things in it that haven't been said? It's a monthly challenge, and the people that put that together are excellent at it.
Yes, I agree. It's good. It's a good magazine.
And of course they follow my example. That's why it's great. And but really, in all candor, it is 15 hours a week. What is there not said? It turns out a lot. And the newsletter is the repository for it. So I'm really flattered that you mentioned that.
Well, whoever had the cover, that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Today, you get a chance to hear from Denise May, who is the creative director, not just for the Limbaugh Letter, but for iHeartMedia and Premier Networks. And Denise, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, James? It's so good to hear your voice.
Well, it's good to hear your voice as well. Now, listen, you came on board. I remember when you came on board, you were a young thing.
Yeah. I was 24 years old. I mean, I can't even, it was amazing.
Yeah. And so, all I remember, we started the newsletter, Diana Aloko, who's the editrix of the Limbaugh Letter. And then the next person that was hired was you. So let me ask you a question. The first time you met Rush, what was that like?
Oh my God, it was at a party. And I was invited to, when we were doing some sort of dinner, and he was standing there, and it was a group, and I think it was John Axton who said, you know, Denise, come over here, I want to introduce you to Rush. And I remember, being completely awstruck. And just be like, hi, I'm a big fan. I'm pretty sure that's what I said. And he went, oh, thank you very much. and like turned around and walked away. And I was like, oh crap. Like, well, I'm such a ding dong, you know? I just, you know, when you meet him, he's, you know, he's got such a presence. And obviously I was just in awe of him.
Okay. So now you, here you are 24 years old and yeah. You're in New York City and here's this job. And mm-hmm. What's it like? What's it like working with Rush?
Oh my gosh, it was such a gas. We were all at WABC Radio. We had these small offices at the end of the hall, and we just had so much fun interacting, and we would sit in the studio while Rush was talking. And obviously, the Limbaugh Letter is a product of the radio show, where we, you know, and take content from what Rush is talking about and expand upon that and create new content. So it was super important for us to like listen in and hear what he was saying. And it was so inspiring. And then, and on top of it, like, you know, hanging out with you and Kit and Mike, and it was just such an inspiration to be there and to experience that energy, you know?
And the Limbaugh Letter continued to grow and get more and more subscriptions, and we all grew with the show and kept going. And so finally we reached the point that brings us to one of the reasons that I asked you here today. Rush's announcement, what you were on the phone.
I think Diana called me and told me. At the time, you know, I've never known anybody to have stage 4 lung cancer, and I've known people that have survived cancer. So I thought if anybody can do it, I mean, obviously, you know, we've been there through a lot of adversity that Rush has faced, you know, and I thought, well, this is just one hurdle that we're all going to like pull together and do what we do best. And, you know, he's going to pull through and he'll get to the other side. I was with you. I mean, I was sad that he had to go through all this, but I absolutely thought he was going to beat it. Yeah.
And were you listening at the moment that Catherine made the announcement, or did you find out about the?
I did. I mean, obviously I heard Catherine make the announcement. I was told beforehand. It was awful. I mean, it was a Wednesday. We were going on press with the Limbaugh Letter on the Thursday that following day. So we were like crazy busy on deadline. The Limbaugh Letter is written in first person, and it's just, you know, it was just so like surreal, because we were like, you know, we always have Rush on the cover. And I think it was Monday, Diana and I had a conversation, and we were like, you know, it's weird. We just had a feeling like things were not good. What do we do? Like, and so we had talked about how we should probably in the case that something should happen to Rush, have something as a backup cover, because we can't have Rush on the cover if he's not here anymore in the same capacity as we have in the past. So we came up with an alternate cover, and that was really difficult, because it was the first cover in 30 years that I've designed that he was not on the cover. And I couldn't imagine doing the Limbaugh Letter without him on the cover. You know, it's just such a staple of what we do and how we visualize the Limbaugh Letter. And the whole Limbaugh Letter is written obviously in his, you know, words and as I, and, you know, we had to kind of rethink that. And it's just, you know, after 30 years, it's just unimaginable to think about how we could do that. And I have so many amazing memories about him and just hanging out with him, and like, and I just didn't see it coming. I really didn't. When Catherine, you know, even when Catherine was talking about it on air, I just was just like, oh my God, I can't. And it was, you know, we had this issue to get out and we were working full blast. And the only thing I kept thinking about is that Rush would want me to finish, and we have to keep going and we have to keep doing what we're doing. And, you know, that's what we do. And so we pulled the cover and put the alternate on, and and we move, and you know, we've been moving forward, and you know, trying to.
Well, let me tell you something about that cover.
Oh. Yeah,
I have that cover was perfect. It.
Yeah.
You know, God is with me.
That cover was the cover we did before he died. That was the cover before. The cover that we did when he died was the one of just the microphone.
Right. The cover that was out, the Limbaugh letter that was out when he died, it was almost like the timing was perfect.
I know. It really was. And it was almost surreal because when we did it, it was interesting. We had when I presented covers to Rush, I often did like a couple different covers for him to choose from. And we had a couple different ideas for that cover. And honestly, we were surprised he chose that one. And we were like, okay. And you know what? Rush is never wrong, ever, ever. Like, you know, sometimes Diana and I are like, maybe we'll do this. And we show him something and he goes with something else. And it's always perfect. It's always somehow he foresees the future. I don't know how he does it. And so that cover, he chose that one. And we were like, oh, okay, great. And, you know, we moved forward. And then later on, when we looked at that, I mean, Catherine held it up at CPAC and it was just like, yeah, he's with God. It's like, it's amazing. And
I was in the room when Catherine held that up and she that was just, I'll tell you, that's a moment I won't forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those people that could see it, you know, they had monitors, people that could see it. You could hear the reaction through the room.
Yeah, it was really impactful. And
Rush chose that.
Yes. And Rush chose that. Rush chose every cover. He was very involved in the covers and I miss that so much. But
let me hear one of those amazing stories about Rush.
Okay. So I know which one you're talking about. So when we were in New York, and I know you were probably there for this, and you might not remember this, but we used to go out all the time, right? And go to like fancy restaurants like Ruth's Chris and 21 Club, and we always had a private room in the back. And we entertained clients when they came in, like advertisers, important advertisers. And once a time, I remember I think Rush was curious about like what I was like or who I was, you know. So I was sitting next to him at dinner and we had a great time. There was, you know, we were always having, you know, so much fun, giggles, lots of giggles with all of us. But at the end of the dinner, he turned to me and he said, you know, Janice, we're gonna smoke cigars. Do you mind moving? And he kind of like gave me this like sheepish grin, like, and I was like, looked at him, and I didn't want to move. I was having way too much fun. So I said to him, I go, well, Rush, you're not gonna offer me a cigar? Like, I like smoking cigars. And he started to laugh and he was like, sure, you can have a cigar. I didn't know you smoked cigars. And he had a humidor and that he always, you know, at those types of things, there was always a humidor. We were always smoking cigars. You know, it was a different time. It was a long time ago, you know. And he opened up the humidor. And of course, you know, now the challenge. He goes, well, which one do you want? Now, right, I know nothing about cigars. I was totally bluffing, right? I mean, like, and I turn to him and I go, well, which one's the most expensive one? And he's starting to laugh because that was the only thing I knew, that there were probably inexpensive cigars in there and there were probably really expensive cigars. And if I was going to do this, like, I got to have the best, right? So So he says, well, this one's the most expensive one or something like that. And I go, well, then I'll have that one. And I love that story because we were giggling and it was sort of him. That was sort of him. Like, he liked to kind of like test you kind of a little bit to see. And it was fun. We just were, that's how we interacted. And we had such a good time. And I remember just enjoying that cigar. And I think I held on to the cigar I didn't smoke the whole thing. I couldn't smoke the whole thing, but like, you know, holding on to it for a really long time, because it was just such a great memory of us all hanging out and having such a good time.
I read a post that you put in tribute on your Facebook page to Rush, and I want you to read it, what you feel comfortable reading from it. You don't have to read it all. You know, if you want to skip over a few things, that's fine too, but give us the gist of that Facebook post, if you don't mind.
So, you know, it was really important to me when he died, and it took me a really long time to sort of like think about how I wanted to honor him. And I have a lot of people who were asking me about my relationship with him, how I was doing, and, you know, what he, and people have, and I'm sure you encountered this, like, what's he really like? And I wrote this post, but it was important to me to put down in words, like, what I was feeling about Rush. And I told, in the beginning of the post, I told a story that I just told about the cigar, because I wanted to give context, like, to how he and I kind of interacted. But I do want to kind of read some of it, if you don't mind.
Yeah, because, please. I want you to. I want you to share this with people, please.
All right. So I'm going to start sort of in the middle. So his friendship was unconditional, but he was first and foremost my boss. Today, it's unheard of to work for 30 years for one person, but I'm not alone in my tenure. His commitment to family values meant unwavering support for his staff's family that instituted unprecedented loyalty. When I proposed something unheard of in 1995, telecommuting, he did not blink an eye and said, "Do it. Show me how it can be done." This was during a time the internet was in its infancy. He was a visionary and self-professed techie. This new idea of working from home intrigued him, and he trusted me to show him the way. He also supported my desire to move to Rhode Island, where my fiancé lived, and keep my job. I packed up my equipment, drove to Rhode Island, fired up my computer and modem, and launched AOL. I sent him a test email, and in return, I received an enthusiastic congratulations, and we never looked back. Over the next 26 years, we exchanged thousands of emails. Our mutual respect meant he entrusted me to work from home with very little oversight, and I, in turn, worked tirelessly to support him to ensure work moved forward, even when he had the misfortune of personal troubles that impacted his ability to work and took him away from the office for months at a time. He had no illusions that his great success was done on his own. Every person who worked for him received recognition for their valuable contributions. He did not often share his appreciation in writing or verbally. It made him uncomfortable. Instead, he sent numerous surprise packages over the years at great personal expense without warning. His generosity knew no limits. He also worked tirelessly for many charities and gave millions of dollars to support them. He did not boast about his charity work because it was not something you did for recognition. It was just something you did because it was the right thing to do. It is purposeful that I do not mention him by name because his name is often wrongfully mischaracterized, creating an unfair bias in many people. It's important to me to share the person I knew without these overshadowing misnomers, to share that we did not always agree, nor did he expect me to, that he always applauded individual thinking and welcomed discourse that differed from his own. There's no denying he said and did things that he admittedly regretted, but haven't we all? The difference is he was brave enough to do it under the public eye, knowing the unfriendly media stood at the ready to pounce, to lie and twist context to suit their agenda. Many people, including my own family, have tried to discredit him, who never took the time to really listen to him. He was not impervious to this injustice aimed at him. He described himself as, quote unquote, a lovable fuzzball, and there is no truer words. It was his unwavering passion for his convictions that fueled his ability to continue his mission that made him great. This mission firmly rooted in his belief in God, individual freedom, and love for his country. His bravery to continue to always speak his truth. It is for this reason he will be remembered as one of the most important men of our time. This man, this legend, Rush Limbaugh, gave me an opportunity when I was 24 years old that turned into a great grand adventure that at the precipice of 54 will be one of the crowning achievements and honors of my life. Many tributes have been made about Rush since his passing from people who are more well-known than myself, but it was important for my own healing process to express my experience. I know my role will not be mentioned in the big picture of the Rush Limbaugh legacy. I'm good with this because I know he thought my contributions were significant, that he valued me, and that I made him proud. My one regret will be that I did not have the chance to really thank him, share with him how much he meant to me, and tell him how much I loved him, and say goodbye to my dear friend. I take comfort knowing Rush is with God, and that we will meet again and share a good laugh over an adult beverage. But for now, I will move forward the way he would want me to and continue to make him proud. So in closing, using Rush's signature sign-off and appreciation that you have done me the honor of reading this far, thank you for listening. It means a lot. It means a lot.
As we near the final episodes of Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, we'd like to offer you sincere thanks for listening to the podcast and a special thanks for those of you who've shared your own stories and Rush memories or have taken the time to write and share reviews of this series. Thank you, one and all. Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, is produced by Chris Kelly and Phil Tower, the best producers in America. Production assistants Mike Mamone and the executive producers Craig Kitchen and Julie Talbot. Our program, distributed worldwide by Premier Networks, found on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. This is James Golden. This is Bo Snerdly. This is James Golden. I'm honored to be your host for this and every single episode of Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. Thank you for being with us.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.